Our New Testament reading is from 2 Corinthians on page 967. We're going to start chapter 7, verses 2 through 16. Make room in your hearts for us. We have wronged no one. We have corrupted no one. We are heart advantage of no one. I do not say this to condemn you, for I said before that you are in our hearts to die together and to live together. I am acting with great boldness towards you. I have great pride in you. I am filled with comfort. In all our affliction, I am overflowing with joy. For even when we came into Macedonia, our bodies had no rest, but we were afflicted at every turn, fighting without and fear within. But God, who comforts the downcast, comforted us by the coming of Titus, and not only by his coming, but also by the comfort with which he was comforted by you. And as he told us of your longing, your mourning, your zeal for me, so that I rejoiced still more. For even if I made you grieve with my letter, I do not regret it, though I did regret it, for I see that the letter grieved you, though only for a little while. As it is, I rejoice, not because you were grieved, but because you were grieved into repenting, for you felt a godly grief, so that you suffered no loss through us. For godly grief produces a repentance that leads to salvation without regret, whereas worldly grief produces death. For see what earnestness this godly grief has produced in you, but also what eagerness to clear yourselves, what indignation, what fear, what longing, what zeal, what punishment. At every point you have proved yourself innocent in the matter. So although I wrote to you, it was not for the sake of the one who did the wrong, nor for the sake of the one who suffered the wrong, but in order that your earnestness for us might be revealed to you in the sight of God. Therefore, we are comforted. And besides our own comfort, we rejoiced still more at the joy of Titus, because his spirit has been refreshed by you all. For whatever boasts I made to him about you, I was not put to shame. But just as everything we said to you was true, so also our boasting before Titus has proved true. And his affection for you is even greater, as he remembers the obedience of you all, how you received him with fear and trembling. I rejoice because I have perfect confidence in you. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks, Jess. All right, good morning again. Good to see everybody. So it's Thanksgiving week. I hope you're prepared. You guys brine your turkeys? Raise your hand if you're a turkey briner. Just a couple? Interesting. All right, got to get started on that soon, right? Well, this year, as the last few years, our family will spend Thanksgiving in a cabin in Vermont. We will be unreachable for 3 or 4 days, and it's going to be glorious. I was sitting with some other pastors this week, and they were all describing their Thanksgiving plans, and I was extremely stressed out by all that they were doing, hosting 15, 20 people, going to see a bunch of family members, not us. We escape to the cabin in Vermont where no one can reach us. You see, most holidays for us involve work of some type, Christmas, Easter especially, and because our family is far from home, or our family's far from here, down in North Carolina, it's usually like surrounded by some sort of crazy travel. So like Christmas, we'll go down to North Carolina a day or two after, and we'll see as many of the 85 family members that we can over the course of 4 days, and then we'll come back. It's kind of wild. I think 2 years ago, we celebrated Christmas 8 times. So we will escape for Thanksgiving to the woods. And if I'm being quite honest, there's times where I am tempted to just adopt this lifestyle for good. Anybody else feel that temptation? As much as I love you guys, and you'll see I'm committed to you all into this life here, and I do believe my life is better with you in it, it's not easier. Right? And that's nothing personal, but that's just the reality of being a human being, right? The more humans that are involved in a thing, the more complicated it is. Right? Humans are messy. They're complicated, even dangerous at times. You ever feel this appeal to sneak off? Maybe life would be a lot easier if it was just you and God. Okay, maybe a spouse, maybe your kids, a couple close friends. Maybe you want to just handpick the people that you spend your life with, because people are messy. They complicate things. They're dangerous. So maybe we should just protect ourselves. If people are messy and complicated and dangerous, why would we ever give ourselves to other people? C.S. Lewis names the problem this way. He says, to love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping your heart intact, you must give it to no one. Wrap it carefully with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in a casket or coffin of your own selfishness. All right, he gets a little negative at the end there, but maybe you were tracking with him like, yeah, that is sort of appealing. But herein lies the danger. As he goes on, he says, in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, your heart will change. It will not be broken, but it will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. This is the danger of the allure of loneliness. And I believe that Paul knew this. This morning, Paul attests to the brokenness of community, the messiness, the complications, the danger even of community, but he also attests to the beauty of community. So we continue our series this morning through the book of 2 Corinthians. Remember, this is a letter that Paul wrote to a church that he started in a place called Corinth. At this point in the letter, Paul is exceedingly joyful. You heard it in the reading. He's exceedingly joyful because at this moment, he's expressing how he has experienced God's comfort in his life. This comfort that we all think might be available to us in that cabin in the woods by ourselves, Paul says, no, he actually experiences it through community. And what's amazing is that Paul receives the comfort of God through the very community that caused him distress. One commentator summarizes it this way. He says, the Corinthians, who had been the cause of Paul's anguish, become the very means by which God brings him comfort. And this is the nature of community, especially Christian community, as we will see it this morning. Christian community, like all community, is broken. It's complicated. It's messy. It's even dangerous. But it's also beautiful. Offers the possibility of the comfort of God in the Christian community. It doesn't take away from the beauty, but it actually contributes to the beauty of Christian community. So this morning, we're going to look at four things. We're going to look at the conflict of community, the comfort of community, the conversion of community, and then the cornerstone of community. So first, the conflict of community. I say conflict. I should probably say conflicts. There's plenty of conflict to look at when we look at community, but Paul identifies two distinct conflicts that he experiences in community, an interpersonal conflict and an interpersonal conflict. First, the interpersonal conflict, the conflict between him and others. He says in verse 2, make room in your hearts for us, for we have wronged no one, we have corrupted no one, we have taken advantage of no one. Here Paul alludes again to the fact that there was a conflict between him and the Corinthian church. So just to remind you of this context once again, Paul had started this church about 5 years prior to this letter. He had built a strong relationship with these people. He led many of them to faith in Christ. He taught them the fundamentals of the Christian faith. They had a real deep, intimate, sweet relationship. Honestly, as I experience it, this describes my relationship with many of you, people who I deeply care for, who have been foundational in my own spiritual journey and whose spiritual journey I have had the chance to influence. This was Paul's experience with the Corinthian church. But a few years after planting the church, he had to leave to go attend to some other ministry responsibilities. And while he was gone, some other teachers came to Corinth and they started speaking poorly of Paul. These teachers were probably more successful than Paul. They were more kind of concerned with their self-image than Paul was. And so they looked a lot better than he did. And they started kind of influencing the Corinthian church to turn against Paul. This would be like if I went on sabbatical for a few months and Matt stepped in. And Matt kind of started planting seeds that maybe I wasn't really a great pastor. Undermining my leadership, suggesting that maybe I didn't have your best interest in mind. And by the end of this sabbatical, some of you started kind of joining in with Matt. Yeah, maybe you're right. Well, that's what happened. Several people did start following these teachers. So Paul has to come back to Corinth. He thinks, maybe if I just go back, they'll remember me. Like, it's me, guys. You know me. But when he goes back, somebody actually, probably as he's addressing the congregation, somebody stands up and opposes him publicly, calls him a fraud, a phony. And nobody else in the congregation stands up to defend him. Can you imagine this? If I came back from sabbatical and I was like, guys, what's going on? And somebody just stood up and directly opposed me and made all these accusations against me, and no one stands up to defend him. This is a heartbreaking scene. So Paul has to leave. He leaves. He's hurt. He's confused. And so he writes a letter to them. This is a letter that came before this letter that we don't have access to anymore. And probably what he's responding to is these three specific charges that he names here in verse 2. He had been charged with wronging the people, maybe some moral failure against the Corinthians. He's been told that he's corrupted them, that he's taught them wrong things. It's been said that he's taken advantage of the Corinthians, that he's been using their own resources for his own personal gain. This is a deep, deep conflict. People that he thought were his closest friends had turned against him. People that Paul loved and gave his life for were making accusations that he had actually taken advantage of them. People over whom Paul had anguished were just sitting there silently while others berated him. It's a heartbreaking experience of the brokenness of community. Friends, if you have church hurt, and I know many of you do, Paul can relate to you. The reality is, this is the danger of close relationships. The possibility that your closest confidants will betray your trust. That your most reliable people will abandon you in your greatest moment of need. That those who you think are your guiding light will leave you in darkness. As I look around, I know that there's no shortage of interpersonal conflict experienced in this room. Maybe not between individuals in this room, though, maybe. But family members, people you thought were your friends. And I'm sorry for this. This is part of our experience of community now. It's broken. Some of you are here because you have experienced church hurt, hurt in relationships, and you think this church is different. I want to warn you that we're not. Now, in some ways, we are. I believe in Presbyterianism partly because of this. There's accountability. But we're not different in the sense that we will never hurt you, that you have no chance of being harmed in this church, that we'll always do the right thing, that you won't experience brokenness here. We endeavor to be a different church with all our heart. I guarantee you of that. But I can't promise that we'll be different. We are all broken. We've said it all morning in the confession. And we don't leave that brokenness outside the church door and suddenly come in perfect people. People hurt. And I think we need to get better at naming this as a church, CPC. I think we're a little too nice, a little too hesitant to ruffle feathers or concerned with saying the wrong thing. I hear that pastors get angry emails all the time. I never get angry emails. Okay, maybe not angry emails. But I think we need to get better at naming conflict, naming brokenness. Paul doesn't just brush the conflict aside, but he brings it to the center. We'll see in a moment that that's what leads to the beauty. We have to be able to name the brokenness, the reality that we exist in broken communities with interpersonal conflict. So that's the first conflict that Paul names. He's experienced this interpersonal conflict between him and the Corinthians, but as a result of this, he's also experienced an interpersonal conflict, one within his own heart. In verse 8, he says, "Even if I made you grieve with my letter, I do not regret it, though I did regret it, for I see that letter grieved you, though only for a little while." I found this to be an incredibly vulnerable and beautiful verse this week. I think here we get this glimpse into an inner conflict that Paul experienced as a pastor. He went away from Corinth and after this conflict with these people, and he ended up writing a pretty harsh letter in response. Again, this letter that we don't have access to. anymore. And this wasn't just like an angry email that he just spouted off in self-defense. But in chapter 2 of 2 Corinthians, he says he agonized over this letter, that he was in anguish when he sent this letter. Seems like he really did wrestle with if he should or should not write the letter. After he sent it, even, he wasn't sure if he did the right thing. The whole time he's grieving in anguish that perhaps his relationship with all of these friends in Corinth was on the line, that he might lose some of his best and closest friends. Again, maybe you've been where Paul is, because this is another constant conflict that we experience if we truly live in community. Now, to be sure, we can avoid this inner conflict altogether if we just avoid conflict and we never engage it. Or some of us are the other type. We just throw conflict out any time that we're hurt or offended. But this inner conflict is what happens when we exist in authentic community authentically. We're going to have this inner turmoil, this anxiety, this uncertainty. Right? Someone says something to you, it hurts your feelings. And you wrestle with if you should say something to them. And if you should, how? And then you do it and you're not sure you're doing it right. And then you leave and you're all stressed about how they responded. Has anybody experienced this? I know even as a pastor, I have. Times where I've walked into meetings knowing that I need to say something hard, but uncertain how I should say it. And then pretty sure I didn't get it all right. Some of you guys have gotten text messages from me after meetings. Sorry, I don't know if I said that right. Because I have this inner conflict, this inner turmoil regularly, and I think we all do as we live in authentic community authentically. Paul had this experience, this inner turmoil about how to interact with those around him, how to experience the interpersonal conflict that he had. So even as I explain all of this, you might be thinking to yourself, yeah, why do I have any friends? Why would I reach out to others and engage in relationship if it results in interpersonal and interpersonal conflict? Is it not better just to avoid all conflict and so maybe avoid all community? Maybe that life in the woods really is my calling. What's amazing, though, is that in Paul's experience, and this is true for us too, that cabin in the woods will not actually bring the comfort that we're longing for. And this isn't a reality just for Christians, but even as I was looking at it this week, secular psychologists support this truth as well. One researcher makes this observation, says people retreat from relationships because it feels easier, but that choice predicts worse mental and physical health outcomes. Social isolation promises comfort, but delivers poorer health than obesity or inactivity. Even secular psychologists are observing that while relationships are hard, isolation is even harder. And what we're going to see here is that for Paul, the very community that caused all sorts of conflict for him was the very conduit that God used to bring him comfort and joy that he longed for. So let's look at that together, the comfort of community. The reason we cannot pull away from community is because it is the very means by which the God of all comfort has chosen for his comfort to be offered to us. We see that first here in verse 6. Paul says, "But God who comforts the downcast comforted us." So the first thing to see here is that God is the source of all comfort. Comfort, all comfort comes from God ultimately. Paul sees that the comfort that he received from the community ultimately was from God himself, and this is good news. Because this means that even if the community failed to bring him the comfort he longed for, it was still available to him. The source was not cut off. And yet, I can't think of a single, I thought of maybe one example in the scriptures where God offers comfort apart from community. I thought of like when the angels appear to people, they say, "Fear not." But aside from that, I think that God's comfort always comes through community. But for those of you who have been hurt by community, I want to tell you that it's God himself who offers comfort. So ultimately, community alone cannot bring you the comfort you're longing for. Only God, the source, can. Paul shows here the beautiful possibility that's available to us. First, he says he's comforted by Titus. He goes on in verse 6, God who comforts the downcast comforted us by the coming of Titus. We haven't heard much about Titus yet, but Titus was a close companion of Paul. It seems like he had a relationship with the Corinthians, but he was going to be faithful to Paul at all costs. So he went and delivered this letter and told the Corinthians what they were doing was wrong. And when Paul met up with him and saw Titus again, it brought him great joy. I want us to see here from this moment that even if the Corinthian church had not responded the right way, Paul was eager to celebrate God's comfort coming to him through anybody. So even just through Titus being faithful, Paul was ready to celebrate God's comfort. Even when many fail, God still offers us vessels of his grace, his comfort. See, I think so many of us, we can look at one to two bad actors who we've experienced in our lives who haven't brought us the comfort of God. And it can keep us from experiencing God's comfort and community ever at all. We can throw out all of community together, all the institution of the church all together. But Paul will not do that. Clinging to comfort wherever it came to him, even if it was just Titus, his faithful friend. But it wasn't just Titus. Paul goes on. God who comforts the downcast comforted us by the coming of Titus, and not only by his coming, but also by the comfort with which he has been comforted by you, as he told us of your longing, your mourning, your zeal for me, so that I rejoiced still more. There was still yet another means of comfort for Paul, and this was the report that Titus brought to him. Titus came and said, look, the Corinthians listened. They responded to your letter, and they've repented. And they love you. They want to reaffirm their support for you. What relief Paul experiences. He thought his relationship with the Corinthians was over. He thought they were going to just continue in this pattern of sin and disobedience. Thought there was little hope for repair for the rupture that had taken place. But to his surprise, the Corinthian church did receive his rebuke, turned back to him, and remained faithful to him. So that Paul's joy is multiplied in full. He's comforted by Titus doing his job. Then he's comforted by the way Titus was received by the Corinthians. Then he's comforted by the way the Corinthians have received him back. It gives this feeling of sort of a symphonic orchestra of joy, right? I hear like one section starting with Titus coming back, a little bit of joy. And then layered on top of that is the Corinthians' good response to Paul. Oh, man, so much joy there. Another section of joy in the Corinthians' support of Titus. And you just hear all throughout this passage all these different layers of joy as people are turning back into community. This is the beauty, the possibility that's available to us only in community. There might be some measure of joy and comfort available to you in the cabin in the woods, just you and God. But it is not this exponential, cascading, even like catastrophic comfort that he's experiencing here. A measure that we cannot get on our own. Do we believe this is possible? Do you believe it's possible for those that hurt you to hear that they've hurt you and turn and apologize? Do you believe it's possible to experience restoration and reconciliation in the church community? Or have we lost all hope? So we don't even try anymore. Somebody hurts us and we just turn away. I believe that only the risk and brokenness of authentic community can produce the type of joy that Paul's experiencing here. Because everybody here could have failed. Titus could have failed to do his job. Corinthians could have failed to turn back to him. Paul could have failed in his leadership. And in some ways, it's that very possibility, this very danger, the conflict of community that led Paul to take joy in the comfort that he received. Okay, so how do we get here? How do we find beauty in the midst of a broken community? Augustine has this beautiful picture. It's actually not a beautiful picture. It's kind of a gross picture, but it's helpful. Augustine says, even dung, if it's put in the right place, it does its work and it produces fruit. If dung is placed on the soil, it is useful to the farmer, but if it is placed on the table, it is an offense. You see, we tend to think that conflict has to be avoided at all costs. It's dung, it's smelly, it's stinky. But conflict in the right place, used the right way, it has the possibility to breed comfort and joy beyond comprehension. This comfort and joy that Paul experiences. So how do we get there? How does dung of conflict get turned into dirt of comfort? We see this in verses 9 through 11, this conversion of community. Paul says, as it is, I rejoice not because you were grieved, but because you were grieved into repenting. For you felt a godly grief so that you suffered no loss through us. For godly grief produces a repentance that leads to salvation without regret, whereas worldly grief produces death. With this conflict between Paul and the Corinthians, there was grief, regret, uncertainty. Paul felt it. The Corinthians felt it. You've felt this in your conflicts. And this grief, it just had the potential to just be a festering pile of poop on the table. That's what would have happened if the Corinthians and Paul had just responded with a worldly grief. This is the type of grief that puts conflict in the wrong place. Like setting a pile of dung on the kitchen table. Worldly grief does this. This would be for Paul just to stare at the conflict with the Corinthians and say, forget you guys, and leave it there, undealt with, unturned, unspoken. Or maybe just leave them angry. Maybe flip out on them. Or for the Corinthians, it would have been for them to just do the same to Paul, to ignore him and say, he's crazy. All this would have done is produced death. Perhaps you know this in your own life. Perhaps you're finding that wrong that someone did to you 5, 10, 15 years ago, you're still holding on to it. And that pile of crap has just been sitting on your kitchen table, festering. And now it's beginning to infect all of your life, all of your relationships. Relationships with your family, relationships with your friends, maybe even your relationship with God. If we don't deal with the conflict in our lives, we just let it sit there on the kitchen table, it doesn't go away, it doesn't breed life. All it does is breed death. But Paul says there's a possibility for that very same conflict to bring life. Paul says there's another type of grief, and this is a godly grief. Rather than dealing death, this godly grief produces salvation without regret. It produces life. This is the type of grief that both he and the Corinthians experienced and expressed. Paul experienced this grief over how things were going, and it led him to angst, anxious nights, wondering, God, am I doing the right thing? Am I in the wrong here? He probably asked Titus. He probably asked others, am I doing something wrong here? Did I mess this up? But having been cleared, he then reaches out to the community and says, come on, guys. Let's be reconciled. Let's clear the air. What's really going on? The Corinthians expressed this godly grief too when they heard from Paul. They listened to him. They probably talked to one another. And they received his rebuke. And they apologized and changed their actions. You see, both Paul and the Corinthians experienced a godly grief, and so they experienced the comfort of God. I think one key element of godly grief, godliness in conflict, it's humility. We see this up in verse 3 where Paul says that God comforts the downcast. That word downcast, pretty much every other time it's translated in the New Testament, it's translated as humble. God comforts the humble. You see, I believe that Paul and the Corinthians both had to have humility in order to experience and express godly grief. Humility to say, maybe I am wrong. And maybe I need to enter into this and listen. Godly humility to receive rebuke, to change when someone tells us we've done something wrong, to apologize when necessary, to forgive when necessary. This humility is the only way that we can experience life in the midst of death. This is how the dung of confrontation is turned into the dirt of comfort. But how can this be possible? How is it possible to have humility in the vulnerable nature of confrontation? You might get run all over. How do we have humility to boldly name when someone's hurt us or to receive someone's rebuke of us? In order to experience this godly grief, I think we must look to the cornerstone of Christian community. See this again in verse 3. Paul says, I do not say this to condemn you, for I said before that you are in our hearts to die together and to live together. You see, I believe that the context where conflict can be converted from death-dealing dung to life-giving dirt is the context of Christian community, which is a covenant community. I think this can happen elsewhere, but I believe that this must happen in the church. The church is the garden where that dung belongs, where that dung can get turned from death to life. Notice the language that Paul uses in verse 3. He says, you are in our hearts to die together and to live together. And I believe what Paul is communicating here, it's not just some sentimental, comment, but I believe that this is actually a true reality. This is just describing their relationship as a covenant relationship. He had taken vows to them. He was committed to them, to die with them. He wasn't going anywhere. That's how this language, life and death, is used in the Bible. It's not just sentimental language, it's covenantal language. These were oaths that were not meant to be broken. This was like the oath that you would take when you joined the military, or the oath that you would take at a marriage. Not a sentimental statement, but a covenant reality. And you see, this is the context where this all can take place. It's not like any old relationship that you have where you could just kind of throw it out when it becomes inconvenient. This is a relationship of vow-protected relationship, covenant relationship and commitment. See, the type of vulnerability that I'm inviting you to, it's dangerous, that's true. But it's why we take vows in the church when we join a church. For richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. Okay, our vows aren't quite like that, but it's the same idea. The vulnerability is protected by the covenant. Just like the vulnerability of sex and marriage, we believe, is protected by the vows that two people take to one another, so also the vulnerability of church relationships, of conflict in church relationships, of humility in church relationships, all that vulnerability is protected by the vows that we take. But there's still yet another level of protection. You see, Paul's ultimate confidence is not in the covenant that he had with the Corinthians, but it's in the covenant that Christ had with him. Because before Paul ever said to the church of Corinth, you are in my heart to die together, to live together, Jesus Christ said that to him. You heard it in our Old Testament reading. I will never leave you or forsake you. This is the promise that God has made to us. Christ initiated this to us on the cross. Christ taking on the ultimate conflict of community. Ultimately rejected. And in turn, he promises to never reject us. So even if our communities fail, Christ never will. This is how we can experience a godly grief. Your life isn't on the line if someone else rejects you. It will hurt. And I want to take that seriously. I don't want to minimize that. But ultimately, you know, like we said in Psalm 27, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? He's not going anywhere. He's made a covenant with us, to live with us, to die with us. Friends, this is why I believe in the church. It's not because we're perfectly pure, we're free of mess. Absolutely not. But I believe that if we really believe what we say we believe, that we have the tools. This is the place where the dung of conflict can get turned into the dirt of comfort. Because friends, our faith tells us in humility, I know I'm not perfect. I know you're not either. So when you tell me I've hurt you or I've failed you, I'm not surprised. When you hurt me, when you fail me, I'm not surprised. We're broken. Our only hope is the grace of God offered to us in Jesus Christ. My only hope and yours. And it's in that faith that we can move towards one another in conflict and experience his comfort. Would you pray with me? God, this is a messy reality. I don't know why you've chosen to do it this way. You could just offer yourself to us uninhibited by the mess of other people. And yet you haven't. You offer us your comfort through the very people who are dangerous to us. The very people who cause us conflict are the ones that also bring us comfort. And frankly, God, I don't know how much I believe this. When I'm hurt by people, I want to just walk away. Easier just not to engage them again. What would it look like to move towards those who hurt us? In humility, in wisdom, that we might experience your reconciliation, your love, God, your grace. This is complicated. It's not easy. So, God, would you give us your spirit to know how to walk the line of offering grace and yet also being wise about boundaries? I got to admit, I don't know how it all works, God. So would you lead us? Would you guide us by your spirit, in your grace, to glorify you? We thank you that you've made a covenant with us, that you will not leave us, you will not forsake us, you will never fail us. Help us to believe, even in the midst of our unbelief.